Hello and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie. I'm Marie Westhaver.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
And we are doing this remotely with Zoom, with new technology, since we're all home in with the pandemic. And Mike and I have been going through the back of the rack to find out good topics to bring to you for things you can be watching while you are at home. And we are going to dedicate this episode to the career of Ingrid Bergman. So Mike, yeah. Where do you want to start with Ingrid?
Well, let me start on an academic note, since it's Howard Community College's radio station. I teach a course on Scandinavian film, and Ingrid Bergman very much factors into it in this respect. I have a week where I actually show an excerpt from one of her early Swedish films, and they're all available now, and I've seen most of them, and some of them are quite good. But the film that I excerpt is Intermezzo from 1936. So again, Ingrid Bergman's a recent graduate of the Royal Dramatic Theater School in Stockholm, you know, born in 1915, very much a young and rising Swedish actress. And Intermezzo was one of her breakthrough roles, not only in Sweden, but internationally. In fact, one of the people who saw that film, and bear in mind it's in Swedish with English subtitles, and she's really young, was the producer David O. Selznick. So as if he didn't have his hands busy enough already getting ready for Gone with the Wind, he actually brought her to Hollywood for a 1939 remake of Intermezzo, co-starring Leslie Howard. So that really was the film that in many ways cemented her, or among the films that cemented her reputation in Sweden, but definitely was the film that, you know, got her to Hollywood so literally that it was, you know, a well-received remake. So when I show that excerpt, what I then do, and again, this is a lineup of Swedish films from silent film era to the present, but obviously Ingmar Bergman is part of that, the other great Bergman, if you will. So having shown the excerpt from Intermezzo, what I then do is show the feature-length film Autumn Sonata from 1978. And ironically, or maybe not ironically, there's a classical music connection between both, because both films involve the world of classical music and the perils and pitfalls of being a star soloist and all that. But cutting to the chase on this, when I show Autumn Sonata from 1978, it was the one time when the two great Bergmans, Ingmar Bergman, the iconic Swedish director, and Ingrid Bergman, by then the venerable Hollywood actress, the one time they worked together. And, you know, and again, she, and in this film, Autumn Sonata, she plays a classical music star, and her daughter's played by Liv Ullmann. And so the usual tension between mother and daughter, but in this case, one is a really great musician, and the other's just a so-so musician. And, you know, you can imagine what those music lessons are like. On a sort of behind-the-door note, as they worked together in the studio, they didn't get along at all, really, Bergman and Bergman. She was very much a star and had a sense of how to do things. He, of course, is accustomed to molding his actors and working with, you know, people within his troupe. And it was like two different systems, if you will, Bergman's way of working with actors and all of her decades of Hollywood training at that point. So it was really just not a very good emotional mix. But it got terrific response in terms of creatively. In fact, she received an Academy Award nomination for Best Actress there. And, you know, on a somber note, it really was her final feature film. So, again, you know, her career is beginning in Sweden in the 1930s and ends in Hollywood. She does some TV work later, but ends in Hollywood, you know, by the 70s, and then ends altogether with her final film, which, you know, by way of bookending, she begins her career in Sweden. She ends her film career with a film shot by, you know, the Swedish director Ingmar Bergman. It's shot, you know, in English, but, you know, very much a Swedish production that way. And it, just one final observation on that in terms of that kind of bookending for a career, as if it weren't confusing enough to have Ingrid Bergman working for Ingmar Bergman. Ingmar Bergman at that time was married to a woman whose first name was, guess what, Ingrid. So you can imagine what it must have been like when anytime you mention, like, Ingrid, this or that. Well, which Ingrid do you mean, number one or number two? But anyway, that's sort of a personal connection, a personal in the sense of, you know, academically how Ingrid Bergman, and of course, both of us in our film courses use Casablanca for sure, and that's one of her most famous roles.
Speaking of the various Ingrids, you know, she has a very famous actress daughter, Isabella Rossellini, but Isabella Rossellini is a twin, and her twin's name is...
I know. You couldn't make this stuff up. I mean, it's just incredible the way that plays out. You're absolutely right.
You know, the interviews with her family, they talk about, you know, it's no mommy dearest kind of story. They She was very much loved and appreciated in her family. But they come back over and over to what drive she had to be a success in her chosen field. And Isabella Rossellini talks about how, you know, it's like anybody who has some sort of gift, you know, whether it's painting or acting, you are driven to do this thing. She said, you know, her only regret growing up is she never got to see her mother that much because she worked so much. And I don't know that you get that sense of Ingrid Bergman in the movie. She seems very soft and smart, but you don't necessarily see a driven personality there. I think she works it very well.
Well, not for the most part, I would say yes, but not entirely yes. And just to very quickly cite Autumn Sonata again, in that film, she has driven herself to become an absolutely top-ranked classical music performer. I mean, everything is, you know, surrounding her career on stage at the piano. And as a consequence of that, she's so driven that way that the Liv Ullmann character playing the daughter hasn't had the strong emotional connection and the amount of time spent with her mother that she wished she'd had growing up, and now as a mature woman, you know, still regretting that. And the mother-daughter dynamic doesn't change with time. Like, the same issues that were there when the Ullmann character was a child are still there as she's, you know, well into her at least 30s by that point. And so the way that plays out, and then very cruelly even, when the Ingrid Bergman character sits down to play, and this is just in their living room, mother and daughter, you know, she plays beautifully, as you'd expect for a top-ranked star. When the daughter sits down to play, she's good, but she's not quite good enough, if you know what I mean. And the mother, in effect, is still giving her a music lesson, like, well, no, this note, not that one, or a little lighter, a little softer, whatever. And the pained look on the daughter's face, like, you know, that she will never satisfy her mother. So that was one role where I think the director, Ingmar Bergman, very shrewdly brought out exactly what you identified, that when you're a movie star, regardless of what your screen image is, however nice you are, or you know, humanitarian as a screen character, there's that drive behind it, which is not always so nice, is it? Because you really have to sacrifice some things in order to get to that place.
Yeah, you almost have to be very single-minded. Now, Mike,
yes.
You mentioned your Scandinavian film class. I teach a class on Hitchcock, and of course we talk about Bergman's movies with Hitchcock, notably Notorious and Spellbound. But let's talk about her Academy Award-winning movie, and the one I think most people at least have heard the term, if not seen the movie, and that is Gaslight. And of course, gaslighting is a verb now, you know, because so many people have seen this movie where a woman's husband tries to convince her that she is crazy so that he can commit her and steal all of her money. And by the way, if you haven't seen Gaslight, you must see it immediately because, first of all, you'll understand why that term became so popular, but also the costume design in that movie is not to be believed. And it's not in his head either, but the clothing's just incredible in that movie. Everything fitted to her perfectly.
Oh, talk about form-fitting outfits, you know, I mean, where it's just, you know, it's totally appropriate in the sense of stylistically, and then, you know, fit it within an inch of the life, you know what I mean? It's like everything, you know, that expression of being poured into a gown?
Yes.
It has that quality of, you know, yeah, it is that quality of, like, not just form-fitting in the sense that she's really beautiful and so show it off, but the fact that she's incredibly stylish and her innate sense of good taste, and of course the studios at that point, goodness knows they had costume departments and they know exactly what to do there.
Yes, she also the hats and everything. I mean, it's just an incredible.
It's a great hat movie.
Line. It's a great hat movie. I just finished the series A French Village, which again has incredible hats in it. Nothing to do with Ingrid Bergman.
Well, you know, but back to Gaslight. Remember, when she hits Hollywood, she almost immediately, you know, gets recognition and becomes a movie star. And the period you're talking about, speaking of hats, let's put the film historian hat on at the moment. You know, Hollywood studio system at its peak in that period, late 30s, you know, through the 40s. You know, she does Casablanca in 1942, and then For Whom the Bell Tolls in 1943, wins the Academy Award for Gaslight in 1944. Immediately after that, what does she do? Spellbound for Hitchcock in 45, Bells of St. Mary's in 45, Notorious for Hitchcock in 46. Talk about being on a roll. I mean, it's just amazing that once she hit her stride, in that period, she couldn't do anything wrong. Now, things start to change by later in the decade and then really change the following decade. But my goodness, what a great run she had in the early 40s, early to mid-40s.
I also think she benefited from the fact, of course, that she was really versatile, but also just that classic beauty. And it's a Hitchcock kind of beauty. It's a Grace Kelly kind of elegance that I think did her well in the movies that I'm most familiar with, Notorious, Spellbound, Casablanca. gaslight, even indiscreet, with again with Cary Grant, which sort
Right.
of feels like, a bookend to Notorious in some ways, but it's a different
Yeah.
director.
Well, it's not coincidental that her actress daughter, Isabella Rossellini, whom you mentioned earlier, really she was famous from birth, actually, or notorious from birth. How could she not be? And we'll talk about that in a bit. But the fact that, she would, by way of her own professional career, really achieve success, initially and primarily as a model, if you will, and then, in that category of model slash actress. And the reason I mention that is Isabella Rossellini is just so incredibly beautiful that it's that still image, which works great in an advertising campaign, but also in the movie sometimes. Like, and David Lynch certainly did that with her in Blue Velvet. There are times where it's just like, hold the shot, hold that profile, just show that face. And the moment you see that face, you're looking essentially at Ingrid Bergman's face, aren't you? I mean,
Yes,
that mother-daughter
absolutely.
connection's.
Yes, absolutely. The
Yeah, that connection is
spitting
so
image.
strong in terms. Go ahead.
I just said the spitting image.
Absolutely there. And so, that's both a blessing, and it's not quite a curse, at least a bit of a handicap. When you have a famous mother like that, speaking of mother-daughter issues, how can you compare to that? When you're beautiful, people say, yes, she looks just like her mother. And then when she's acting, well, she's really good, but oh, look at what her mother did. And I don't want to make too much of out of that, but just simply there's an inherent pressure when you have a really beautiful mother, and your own beauty is always traced back to your mother's. And then when you have acting talent, which Isabella Rossellini definitely has, but where people always will say, well, she's good, but look what the mother did.
It would be interesting, actually, to if somebody would remake one of Hitchcock's movies like Notorious or Spellbound and use Isabella Rossellini in the Ingrid Bergman part.
It would either be great or such a memorable freak show that people would talk about. You know what I'm getting at? It's like talk about a risky gamble. You know what I'm getting at? I mean,
Yes.
if it paid off, it could pay off big time, but if it didn't, oh boy. So I generally don't like remakes just in principle, and particularly when you have really iconic films. Strictly speaking, I don't want to have a remake of Casablanca or Gone with the Wind or anything, or Gaslight or anything like that. Though I realize sometimes films like that are either remade or nearly remade in terms of the elements. But I don't know. I just think it'd be kind of hazardous to have her like overtly play her mother that way. It's a kind of dress up that I think could send somebody to a Freudian analyst.
Well, that's an interesting way of looking at it, but you could be onto something there.
Or on something, one or the
Well,
other.
you can't really talk about Isabella Rossellini without mentioning the big scandal
Oh, we have to.
that Ingrid Bergman became involved with the director that she was working on with Stromboli, right?
Well, yes, and actually, let's preface it this way, because not all of our listeners will realize the extent to which she was not only one of the most famous and most successful Hollywood actresses of that era, early through mid into late 40s, but the image that she struck. And we alluded to this earlier. There's that goodness within her, that integrity that you certainly find it in Casablanca and Notorious, so many of the films. The one I would mention is not a particularly good film, doesn't hold up, but it's an important period piece in terms of what that image was. The Bells of St. Mary's from 1945. Well, and also she'd been, Joan of Arc in 1948. I mean, she had this image here of, that she would have high ideals, and so much so you could burn her at the stake, right? She really has, she had a lofty sensibility. And not, it sounds like I'm being sardonic. I'm really not. I mean, she really had this kind of pure, not just the pure beauty, but the pureness in an ethical sense. She almost always played, really ethical characters, and sometimes religious or quite, in effect, religious images. So she had all that going for her, okay? And of course, movie audiences and just the public in general, they make that identification as, one would expect between the actor and the types of roles or type of role for which the actor is best known. And they assume that not only that one is the other, that they're synonymous, but that they should be. If you play these saintly characters, well, your private life better match up point to point there. But to take us into the Notorious affair, she had been married to a dentist, Dr. Peter Lindstrom. And in fact, they had married in 1937. They had a daughter, Pia Lindstrom, who in her own right became well known as a journalist, as a TV broadcaster. She left her dentist husband, which I think is foolish. If you have a good dental plan, you should not give it up. You know what I mean? Like, I would not walk out on any marriage to a dentist. Are you kidding? You get free dental care and, inspections whenever you want. But she left the husband, and again, in Hollywood, it's not unusual for people to get divorced. But what happened was, when she left him, it's because she had taken up and had, an initially adulterous affair with Roberto Rossellini, one of the great Italian film directors. You know, Rome, Open City, Italian neorealism, really, really such an important director. And even though Americans, for the most part, weren't watching a whole lot of Italian movies, the Cognoscenti were. They certainly knew him then. And if you went to art houses, and a little beyond that even, he would be known. But then he became really known because Rossellini and Ingrid Bergman began this love affair. And so they actually married in 1950. And as we mentioned earlier, you know, in terms of children, they had a son. They also had twin girls. And we talked about Isabella as the most notable of the kids. And to give a sense of how scandalous this was, and this is where social mores really have changed quite a bit from then to now, she was essentially blackballed in Hollywood. In other words, producers were not going to work with her because of the initially extramarital affair, and then the fact that, you know, she takes up with this foreigner, right, this Italian, and then she makes movies with him, some of which are, you know, what we'd call art house films, not really as commercially oriented as most Hollywood films. So for several reasons, the extramarital affair and even being sanctified by marriage is not enough there, the fact that she's, you know, making these arty movies in Europe, all that stuff, she was no longer a good American girl, if you will. We'll leave aside the fact that she was actually a Swedish girl, but she's no longer a good Swedish American girl. And I'll give one final example just how extreme this was. She was actually denounced on the floor of the United States Senate. And one senator in particular, but some others, they actually made lengthy speech from the well of the Senate denouncing Ingrid Bergman. One referred to her as, quote, Hollywood's apostle of degradation, close quote. And another quote from those Senate floor speeches referred to her as, quote, a free love cultist, close quote. I mean, my goodness, it's one thing to have people be critical of you, but my goodness, they're going to burn her at the stake like Joan of Arc again.
You know, it's interesting you bring up, you know, how things were perceived at that time, because I watched some interviews with her kids, and Isabella Rossellini was saying that at one time, you know, Pia came to live with them. And she said, you know, they had been growing up as typical Italian kids, and here comes this tall, blonde, older sister, super cool, who wore pants.
Yeah.
Which was, of course, shocking at the time. She said she dragged her everywhere and showed her off. This is my sister. This is my sister. And it's funny now when we think about it, because even though Pia Lindstrom has, you know, I think she's a Swedish newscaster or something. She
is. No, no.
But everybody
no, she,
Isabella.
You know, Marie, she actually is well known in her own right as a TV journalist, as a broadcaster. And in
she
other
also,
people who.
She also looks quite a bit like Ingrid Bergman.
Yeah, it doesn't hurt, you know?
It never hurts.
No, are you kidding? I mean, anyone could be a TV star. No, but she really, she's perfectly competent, as they say. In other words, you know, I've seen clips of her, you know, doing TV newscasts and interviews and all this. And you know, yeah, she looks strikingly like her mother, and she's really beautiful. But, you know, she's good in that profession, if you know what I mean. I mean, she really, you know, whether she would have achieved that totally on her own is a matter of, and always will be, of speculation. But, you know, certainly the family connection may have been a boost in some ways, but also may not have always been a boost when we talk about the scandal. But in any event, cutting to the chase on that, Pia Lindstrom, you know, she had an independent career there. She really did well. And so, you know, say what you will against, you know, Hollywood stars who have multiple marriages and you know, scandals and this and that, but Ingrid Bergman proved to be a, you know, a pretty good mother, I would say, right, in terms of, you know, the kids turned out all right, as they say. There's yet another marriage, actually, that follows after that. After she actually, now, it's interesting, when she split with Rossellini, bear in mind, you know, Italian Catholic ethos here. I mean, you know, the Catholic Church at that time would not have allowed divorce, would it? So what people would do, and this is what they did, was Rossellini had the marriage, or the two of them, they had the marriage annulled in 1958. And that's typically how Catholics would handle it in that era. The Catholic Church would not sanction divorce again, but you could, you know, cite various reasons for annulment. It becomes a semantic game in some ways, like, well, okay, we'll call it an annulment. It ends the marriage. It amounts to divorce, but it was annulled. And after that, Ingrid Bergman married a Swedish stage producer, Lars Schmidt, and then they would divorce in 1975. So she certainly had a love life, every bit as active, I would say, as her Hollywood career.
Yes, but, you know, apparently even with all the beauty and fame and career, she apparently couldn't pick them. because they all seem to flame out. Because strangely enough, all these men cheated on her. Apparently, it's not enough to have Ingrid Bergman.
I've always wondered about that. I mean, if you had Ingrid Bergman, why would you look elsewhere? Why would you cheat? I mean, again, it all has the makings of a Hollywood melodrama, but you're right. You know, Rossellini certainly was very much an Italian film director. We talk a lot about Federico Fellini that way. I mean, if you're married to Giulietta Messina, you got it pretty good. But that he was always philandering, always having affairs. She was always forgiving him and starting over again. Sort of like, you know, the character that Marcello Mastroianni will play in 8 and a Half, right? You know, you're married to a long-suffering wife, and goodness knows that she has reason to be unhappy with you, but somehow she always takes you back. But yeah, Rossellini certainly had that Italian macho quality. I'm trying to think of how politely to phrase it. He certainly had some wandering eyes or wandering hands, and, you know, he certainly was cheating that way. And yeah, you're right. You know, the husbands tended to wander. Maybe that's another aspect of the culture of that era. It was that, you know, men, you know, remain married, but they also remain adulterous. Not that they have a copyright on that. We could think of so many examples today, but certainly in that period, and for men of accomplishment like Rossellini, it seemed to go with the territory, didn't it? That, you know, you had your wife and you had your mistress. And in fact, there are a lot of Italian films, particularly Italian comedies of the 1950s and 60s, that play off of that. You've got your wife at home and you've got your mistress that you're keeping on the other side of town.
But fortunately, no one calls you a free love cultist. So, Mike, real quick, of all the movies that Ingrid Bergman has done for listeners, if they can only pick one, which one would you tell them to see?
Oh, well, that's easy. Casablanca.
And because? I mean, besides the fact that it is a classic and it is, again, another great hat movie.
Well, it's one of the greatest Hollywood films, and, you know, we could spend the half hour just talking about Casablanca, and certainly since we use it in the classroom, we do spend a half hour talking about it more, even. But in terms of the role she plays there, bear in mind, you know, the story's set in Northwest Africa. It's a city where there's a volatile political mix in terms of the Vichy French government, the German army, the Nazis exerting their influence on the Vichy French, Humphrey Bogart's character running the, you know, Café Americain, other nationalities as well. But to cut to the immediate point with the Ingrid Bergman character, the fact that, now, you know, she is, of course, a Swedish actor, and the character she plays, Ilse Lund, in Casablanca, is presented as Norwegian. So fair enough. If you've got the Scandinavian accent there, no need to explain it further. But the fact that she's part of the you know, opposition to the Nazis, and so she and her husband, and the husband's character is Czech, they are really part of, you know, the opposition forces, and they are, you know, doing everything they can to fight the Nazis, even though both of their countries, whether Czechoslovakia and Norway, have been overrun by the Nazis. So they're very much part of the resistance effort, and her character is so noble. And that Ingrid Bergman's perfect in it because, you know, she's really beautiful and really smart and just, you know, the whole package, as they would say, and beautifully costumed, if you want to talk about hats and dresses. But the fact that she has those higher ideals, that she and her husband are putting their lives on the line to fight against the Nazis. And even when, in the backstory in Casablanca, even when the Ingrid Bergman character has a love affair with Humphrey Bogart's character, she would never knowingly, the character this is, she would never knowingly have an extramarital affair. It's her understanding at that point that her Czech husband is dead. She had been arrested by the Nazis, put in a concentration camp. She'd heard, and again, you live on rumor in wartime, she'd heard that he was dead. And so that's why when she had the affair with Humphrey Bogart, so far as she knew at that time, she was a widow. And so ethically, who could throw a stone at her? But then, of course, she finds out that, no, indeed, the Czech husband is not only still alive, but on the outskirts of Paris. And she suddenly leaves to rejoin him. She can't possibly tell the Humphrey Bogart character all the reasons for her actions and the whole story there, because, again, in wartime, you don't want to give out any more information than you need to, because, you know, if you're arrested and tortured, you don't want to have information that would be damaging. So she can't possibly tell him all that at the moment. She just disappears. He's left standing like a jerk on the train platform with, you know, rain coming down on the explanatory or partially explanatory note. And so the point I'm making there is just in a film like that, you realize what high ideals she represented. And even when she has, you know, a love affair, it's handled in the script in such a way that it not only circumvents the production code, the censors, you know, it's okay, she's not having an extramarital fling, it's okay, but the fact that it's so carefully engineered that you still end up admiring her as much as you always did. There's never a moment to think somehow that she's sinning or weak or blah, blah, blah. She's so high-minded that, you know, she'll do what she needs to do for the resistance effort, for the cause. So, you know, again, it's just a really powerful film in so many ways, but in terms of her character type, you can understand why she had that image in the 1940s. She's really beautiful, and she's driven by really high ideals.
Very well put. Well, of course, I'm going to recommend Gaslight because it is such a classic in terms of, you know, what that word has now, you know, become. And she's also excellent in it and won the Academy Award for Best Actress for that role. But I would also say, especially if you've just seen Casablanca, to watch Notorious because it's a great World War II kind of a movie and has, again, Claude Rains in it from Casablanca. So you get to see them, you know, take different kinds of roles. And in this one, she is trying to ingratiate herself into his world because she is working as a spy in cahoots with Cary Grant. And it's a great movie in terms of, well, just the lighting and the setting and the interplay between those three leads. It's just a really excellent example of an actress playing against two very, very dynamic actors, and yet she still stands out.
Yeah, and the fact that both Casablanca and Notorious are so very directly playing off of topical events, really, in terms, I mean, you could say Hitchcock's MacGuffin doesn't matter that much to him, Uranium 235 and so on, and Notorious, but in a way it does, because people going to the movies in that World War II period, or Notorious released just the year after the war, it really reminds them of all sorts of things that were in the headlines. And another reason why, again, when people make an identification between Ingrid Bergman's personal character and the character she's playing, they're thinking about her, frankly, as one of the great Hollywood actors who helped get them through World War II. You know what I mean? I mean, that she was inspirational that way.
You'll even see if you watch these two back to back that she wears a striped shirt in Casablanca in one of her fabulous outfits. And then in Notorious, it's almost an homage to that top. Except now it is kind of sparkly, spangly, and it's a midriff top. But it does remind you, if you're, you know, paying attention to, because everything's in black and white, you notice all those details so much more. It's like they've taken that character, but given it a twist. So it's still Ingrid Bergman, like you liked her in Casablanca, and she still has that underlying morality, but it's just a little bit quirkier.
It is, and a reminder that, you know, Hollywood movies were becoming quirkier in that mid-40s to late-40s period. You know what I'm getting at? And I don't want to overstate that, but the fact that, you know, there could be some quirks there, perhaps even more so than you would have found earlier. And I hesitate to say that the films became more mature that way, because that's, you know, oversimplifying it. But the fact that they sort of looked on recent films, like if you were making Notorious, yeah, of course you're thinking back on her earlier films and, you know, what her image is and kind of tinkering with it, you know what I mean? And as you mentioned with costuming, you can see examples of how, you know, you don't want to totally break the mold of, you know, what she was doing before, but you want to work with that and then refashion it. Speaking of fashion, refashion it in such a way that it's, you know, particularly suitable for the immediate subject matter at hand. And then by way of, if it's more mature that way, well, yeah, you've gone through World War II, and then, you know, you have a World War II themed story like Notorious, and you're kind of already sort of thinking back on that period as well. In other words, you know, this has to do with the filmmakers, not just Hitchcock, but, you know, here's a film being made in the wake of World War II. So you have those years that you're thinking about as you make it.
It's kind of like what you were saying earlier about, you know, why would you waste a perfectly good opportunity to have free dentistry? Why would you waste your Ingrid Bergman if, you know, if you had one to work with? So that is actually bringing us to the end of our segment here. But make sure you check us out on dragondigitalradio.podbean.com, and we will see you at the movies.
See you then.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.